everyone. It's May 10th, 2007, and this is The Image Doctors, a production of Nikonians Talk Radio. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker, and this is episode number 40.
All right, the big 4-0, huh?
Yep.
Excellent. So what do we got on tap for today?
Well, we're going to talk about several subjects. I think we're going to start off by you doing a mea culpa on something that you talked about last episode. But then after that, we're going to talk a little bit about our trip to Texas. And actually, the day that this comes out, on we'll actually be down in Texas doing some bird photography with a group of people that are joining us. So we'll talk a little bit about that and what we're doing to get ready, what we're taking, some of your new play toys, of course, that you've gotten for the trip. And then we're going to do a segment on light meters. And we're going to talk a little bit about how a handheld light meter might still fit in with your photography, whether you're using film or you're using a digital camera. There can be benefits both ways. And then we're going to do our little prescription that we always do, and that'll talk about sports photography settings.
Cool.
So there, do you want to say, I'm sorry?
I have to, yeah, for our good listeners out there who actually understand auto ISO better than me, we have a little bit of an errata that needs to be corrected. I said 2 weeks ago that the auto ISO indicator in the viewfinder will start blinking when you are outside its boundaries, when the light drops off too far. And I was wrong. It blinks all the time when it's enabled. So what that means for those of you who are using auto ISO is not much other than just pay attention to your light meter in the camera. If you think the light is really dropping, if you see that the ISO setting has maxed out, depending on your camera, that might be 800, that might be 1600. Just pay attention to see if that light meter isn't starting to give you something than a dead on reading. That's your hint. So I apologize that I got that one wrong, but that's good. That means you guys are actually listening to us. And when you catch idiot statements by myself or Rick, usually they're by me, please send us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org to point out the error of our ways so that we can repent in the following episode.
All right. Let's go on to our upcoming trip. Talk about something fun.
Oh, I'm so excited to be going back down to South Texas, the Rio Grande Valley.
Yeah. And if you listen to our podcast from a little over a year ago, you can hear about all the details. But at this time, there will be a group of people going with us, and we're pretty excited. That makes it more fun for us, actually. And so we'll be spending several days sitting in holes in the ground, hopefully not being bitten by snakes, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I think that would be an ideal mm-hmm. way to spend 2 days is yep. sweating in a hole in the ground. But more importantly, we'll be trying to get pictures of birds, rabbits, snakes, anything else that might come by in front of the blind. And hopefully we leave with 4 satisfied, happy customers.
I think we will. There's a wonderful diversity of subjects down there. It's a great place.
Where we're going is called the Dos Venadas Ranch. And it is actually set up for photography. And if you wanted to go out there yourself, you can check out the website. I'll put a link to it on the show notes page at blog.nikonians.org. Just go onto the Image Doctors Talk Radio show notes. And then you can get an idea of the kinds of animals that you might see in the blinds. If you want to schedule a visit there, it does cost some money, but you're on private property and the funds go to help support that private property, maintain the natural habitat in South Texas. Instead of being just cleared out and turned into agricultural land, there's incentive there for these ranch owners to maintain their natural habitat.
Yep, and it's a good thing.
So I started packing. I haven't made my full list yet, but I did start packing for the trip. And go figure, we're both packing probably pretty similarly.
Yeah.
So I just thought, since we've talked about packing for a trip and we got a trip coming up, then what do I have in my bag? And first of all, I'm bringing the Think Tank Airport Antidote bag. Mm-hmm. And that's this will be the first time I've actually taken it anywhere.
Yeah, and if you recall listening to the podcast where I talked a little bit about the trip that I made to the last AMPAT to the Smoky Mountains, that's what I took on that trip.
And so I have fit in this bag, which is lying open here down in the mountain bunker. I've got the Nikon 200-400 VR lens in the middle of the bag.
That'll be the bread and butter lens for this trip for certain.
Yeah, pretty much I won't be doing much else. I've also fit in there my D2X body, my 105 VR micro, macro lens, just for fun.
Scorpions and bugs.
Yeah, and during the middle of the day where we might not be in the blinds, sometimes bugs can be fun to take, you know, if you're just bored. I've got an SB800 in there. I'll be bringing the fifth battery, some spare batteries. I've got an SC17 sync cord to so that I can use the flash on a flash bracket. I'll be setting up my big lens on the Wimberly Sidekick. I have a TC14E, and my 10.5 fisheye lens fits in there underneath it quite nicely. And I still have some other room, so for some other things, I'll be bringing the battery charger for the D2X, a spare battery, so I'll have two batteries. I've got my Copper Hill sensor brush in case I get a little dust on the sensor. That'll work pretty well. I'll throw in my Giotto's rocket blower as well. And a better beamer flash extender. Those things.
Important accessory.
Those things. I may actually ditch the L bracket and leave that at home just to save some weight. I haven't decided yet. I always try to pack, an extra Allen wrench and tripod, wrench. But there's a catch here. If you put those in your carry-on luggage, the TSA, the transportation security people, they have a thing against what they call tools. Huh. And if you have an Allen wrench, they'll make you throw it away.
You know, I've taken mine.
Yeah,
they've never done that.
I had to throw away an Allen wrench once. Yeah. Now I have a zillion of them because I get a new one every time I buy anytime I buy one of those Kirk or Really Right stuff.
Well, I'll just throw it in my check luggage in case.
The little wrench that comes with my Gitzo tripod and the Allen key, I usually throw those in the checked bag. So I think that's mostly what I'm taking. I don't plan on going hardcore on this trip, because when you're in a blind, you're not going to be doing a lot of changing of lenses. I learned that last time the hard way, that all those extra lenses I brought just ended up being dead weight.
Yeah, and that's pretty much true for me too. Now, before we talk about your new tripod toy, I'll just talk about, you know, some slight variants that I'll be taking on the trip. Most of it's the same. I'll take a TC17E converter also for just a little bit of added reach. You know, the brief tests I've done with the 200, 400 indicate that it works pretty well. I haven't had, you know, we went out shooting, doing some bird photography the other week, and I tried that 17E, and it worked very well. Sharp images, and I really didn't have any autofocus problems, so I'm
going
to bring it, and I think it'll work better than that TC20E that I took last time. I wasn't that satisfied with it. So I'll have that. I haven't decided for sure if I'm going to take the 105 macro or the 200 macro. I'll take one of the two. And, I'm going to take the D200 body just as a backup, and then we can both kind of share it as a backup just in case something goes awry. Other than that, pretty much same stuff.
Now, we got some new memory cards.
Oh, yeah.
Just came the other day. And these were the... they happen to be on sale, so I kind of jumped on it. The memory prices are really plummeting. So there's no excuse now not to get at least a 4-gig card. We actually purchased a couple of these 8-gig cards, and these are the new SanDisk Extreme 4s. So I'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah, got them from Roberts, right?
Yeah, good people, and they had a sale, so which is now over. That's the bad news. The good news is the price came down a little bit, and there's a rebate on them. So the sale price and now the current price with the rebate is about the same. So under $200 for an 8-gigabyte
it's amazing.
Extreme 4 card. And you're probably asking us what's the difference between the speeds of these cards, and we've mentioned it before. We've talked about... probably won't see a big difference in any of the current camera bodies. Once upon a time, the faster cards made a real difference in the write speed to your camera. But if you're using anything from a D40 on up, pretty much, the buffer in your camera is fast enough, you're not going to have an issue with write speed. And the accelerated cards get you to a certain point, but the write speed is sort of defined by your camera. Where you really can potentially see a difference, though, is in your download speeds to your computer. And so I just did a little testing because these cards just showed up the other day, and so I haven't really had a chance to use them. But I wanted to see what my transfer rates were going to be. And I learned a few things. And one of the things I learned is that the transfer rate that they write on the transfer rate that they say is the, you know, on the packaging, you know, you can get that speed, but it only comes in certain, you have to have the kind of the right circumstance. And the right circumstance is the right reader, the right computer, and a big hard drive.
And also not doing any metadata.
Well, that's what I mean, the right kind of transfer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean, if I just take the memory card and insert it in the card reader, and it shows up as a little icon on my desktop as a drive, and if I just manually copy the files over, just do a traditional copy-paste job into a folder, I was able to achieve, with the Extreme 4 and the FireWire 800 variant of the Extreme 4 reader, something like 38 megs per second transfer rate. In reality, I will never get to that transfer rate because that is not how I transfer the files in my computer. If you're using a file transfer utility like PhotoMechanic or Nikon View or
Lightroom
Aperture,
Bridge,
it's going to create a folder. It's going to do a few other things, and that's going to slow down the transfer rate. So instead of 38, I was getting somewhere around 25 megs per second. Yeah.
And often one of the things that you're doing there is inserting your metadata stuff.
That's
copyright
right.
Information.
Rotation information.
Right.
All of those things that you sort of take for granted.
Slow things down.
That does cause you a hit on your bandwidth. That's okay, though. So what I found is that it's still twice as fast as what I was getting with the Extreme 3 cards, provided that I was using the Extreme 4 reader.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't use the Extreme 4 reader, then I saw no difference in transfer rate into my laptop, for example, between the Extreme 3s and the Extreme 4s. So if you don't have a fast computer, you don't have a really fast hard drive, then the Extreme 4 doesn't get you anything. But if you do have a computer that has the USB 2 or the FireWire 800 and lots of hard drive space, then that SanDisk reader coupled with these cards, or any of these higher end readers that are accelerated, I should say, are going to give you a benefit with those faster media.
Now, we both should be in a lot better shape this year downloading images on our trip than we were last year. Because if you remember, both of us had our old laptops.
Oh, gosh.
And those were old, doggy, awful things. And, you know, a little bit slower cards. And on a trip like this where you're taking a lot of images, it really does make a difference.
Yeah, it was
a lot of times where I was thinking, God, is my flash card ever going to finish downloading?
Mm-hmm. I think it was taking me somewhere between 15 and 20 minutes to download a 4 gig card.
Mm-hmm.
And I can probably now download the 8 gig card in less than 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
possibly even under 10 minutes. So yeah, the half hour transfer into your computer is no longer an issue.
Yeah.
And that's just good all the way around because you save battery time, you know, depending on where you are.
Yeah.
So that's our preliminary report on these new SanDisk cards.
Mm-hmm.
They I'm sure they'll come in handy. So we've gotten to the point now where you almost don't need a portable storage device.
Yeah, it's really heading that way.
Other than for a viewer.
Which I don't use them as much for that really. So okay, so your new toy.
Yeah, I set aside a small portion of my savings account and picked up a new Gitso tripod. This is one of the 6X carbon fiber series, and I did it for two reasons. I have a Gitso 1325, which I bought about 4 years ago. And it's still just fine.
Mm-hmm.
It works great. There's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. It has certainly enough load capacity, about 22 pounds, to hold pretty much any of the lenses that I have with relative impunity.
Mm-hmm.
But I was kind of enamored by this new one for a couple of reasons. This is the newest. This is the 3540 LS is the one that I purchased. Mm-hmm. There's a couple different variants of it. Like the 1325, it has no center column. All of the Gitso models that are designated with an S at the end are missing that center column. And I don't miss that because we've discussed that before. We don't need that. But the real reason why I got it was because it's a four-section tripod. And unlike the earlier models of four-section tripods, this one is rated to 39 pounds. which is substantially more than my 1325. It stands almost as tall, but when I fold it down, it's shorter.
But the most important thing is, unlike those early four-section tripods, it doesn't take forever to set up.
Right. And then that's just, as far as I'm concerned, that's the icing on the cake. I was really interested in getting a four-section tripod that I knew I could put the 200 to 400 on. But Gitzo has, for a long time, been criticized for the painful operational use of their leg locks. They're a simple design. They're easy to clean in the field. Don't get me wrong. But if you don't unlock the legs in the right order, you end up twisting the tubes and the hires, and it can be a real pain in the butt. Mm-hmm. And so they've designed new leg locks, which are called, I think, the G-lock system, something like that. You can open these in any order, so you can just quickly untwist all three of the locks and then just pull out the entire leg. It's pretty cool. It does make it nicer. As a feature by itself, I wouldn't use that to justify spending another $600 on a tripod, you know, but it will last forever. The leg locks are better, but if you're interested,
or at least until you find something nicer.
Yeah. But if you're on the fence and you're thinking about replacing your aluminum tripod with the carbon fiber ones, the new Gitzo designs with the 6X carbon fiber series is really nice. And to boot, it's about a half a pound or a little over a half a pound lighter mm-hmm. than the 1325, mm-hmm. which is astounding if you ask me. It weighs less and it holds more, mm-hmm. and it has great leg locks.
Yeah, no, it's a nice tripod. So, I probably won't get rid of mine, but it's
yeah,
a
if
nice
you already
tripod.
Got a four section, it's
I am slightly
it's,
jealous.
It's
but
not
I'll get over it.
Well, so that's what we're bringing. I think, are we leaving anything out? No, I think that's about it. I'm sure we'll forget something and we'll tell you about it next time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
lots of batteries for the flashes.
Right. Extra batteries, rechargeable ones, of course.
Yep.
So let's talk about light meters, Rick.
Yep.
That's something that I don't have a lot of experience in. So you brought your light meter over today and we played with it a little bit.
Yep. And we tried some experiments and stuff just to demonstrate benefits of certain modes and things like that.
So you got this handheld light meter and yours happens to be a Siconic, but there's other ones out there.
Mm-hmm.
Why invest? These aren't cheap.
No.
I mean, these are a couple hundred dollars.
At least.
And so this is not cheap. And, well, my camera has a light meter in it.
Right.
And it has spot metering and center weighted.
Uh-huh.
And it has matrix metering. Why would I want a handheld light meter? What is the advantage of it?
Well, you know, first of all, you know, I've had this for several years. And the one I've got is one that works in both spot metering mode, and it's got a zoom spot meter. It goes from 1 degree to 4 degrees. And then it also does incident metering, and it has a nice LCD display. The model is one that's not made anymore. It's called an L608. But when I got it, I was predominantly shooting film, and that's medium format film and 35 millimeter film. I wasn't doing any digital stuff at all. And I found it extremely helpful, especially with some of the older camera bodies I was using at the time. And then we'll talk a little bit more about, you know, recent ones and how it'll benefit those later. But the motivation was, you know, I like doing a lot of landscape work. And for example, the camera I was using at the time was my old F4, which I actually happen to have here with me. And the F4 was actually a very cool camera body for landscape stuff because you could use it in matrix mode, you could use it in center weighted mode, and you can also use it in spot metering mode, which was, you know, very cool for certain subjects with landscapes. The only problem with it was it only had one spot metering area inside the viewfinder. And let's say I was out there doing, you know, some stuff at sunrise, I'd get the camera set up, get it the shot composed the way I wanted it, and then, you know, wait a little bit for the light to start changing, and it would change pretty rapidly. So when the sun would come up, there are a couple things that I would want to know. One of them was, what was the range of brightness in the scene? And a good way of looking at it is I would look for a medium-toned object in the shadow area, and then a medium-toned part in the bright area. It could be a patch of the sky. And I would want to know what the brightness difference was, so that I could whip a grad filter out of my bag and get the right one. And if I was trying to do that with the spot meter built into the camera, I would have to unlock the camera from its position that it was composed on and then start moving it around. And then that wouldn't only be at the beginning. As the light changed, I'd have to do it again later, and it was just a real nuisance. Whereas if I used the handheld meter, I could just keep the camera fixed and then, you know, check it with the handheld meter and no problem. You know, anywhere in the frame I wanted to point the spot. And I could see if I wanted to use a three-stop grad or a two-stop grad, because it would change as the light varied as the sun was coming up.
And we should point out that when you talk about pointing the spot, mm-hmm. this light meter actually has a lens on it. You look through.
Yeah, and it's got a little viewfinder.
And so you point that at whatever you're looking at and get the meter reading off of that spot, however.
Yeah, and this one being kind of a super-duper fancy thing, will either read off the shutter speed and aperture in the viewfinder, or you can have it display the difference in f-stops. So, you know, in that scenario I was talking about, I can, you know, push a few buttons on there, and it will tell me whether it's a two-stop difference between the dark and light or three stops. You know, it's very handy for that. So the big thing for me was not having to recompose the shot in order to use a spot meter. And still today, when I go out and shoot film, which I do fairly frequently in medium format cameras, this is what I'll take along, because it really is convenient. It's not something about being a purist. It's all about convenience and getting it to do what I want it to do. Because with my medium format cameras, they've got spot meters, but you can't move them around. They're fixed in the center mm-hmm. of the frame.
Now, just for the sake, because I'm a dummy mm-hmm. when it comes to meters, what parameters, if you're just using this light meter, what parameters do you enter into it so that then you can get, you know, some meaningful information out of it?
Not much. With this one that I have here, you set the ISO. And in fact, you can have two ISOs set in there, which is kind of nice if you're switching between different bodies or backs and different films. But you put that in there, and you tell it whether or not you want it to read off in whole f-stop and shutter speed increments, or half or third. And that just depends on what camera and lens that you're using. And that's just a matter of
convenience. Can you tell it the aperture?
Yeah, you can tell it either the aperture or the shutter speed you want to use, and it'll tell you the other.
So if I came in here and said, all right, we're at, today we're shooting at ISO 200, mm-hmm. and I know I want to shoot at f5.6 because that's the depth of field that I want, mm-hmm. kind of like aperture priority mode, then this will take all that into consideration and then give me the shutter speed that's appropriate mm-hmm. for that. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yep. And the reason that whole shutter speed, half shutter speed, third stop shutter speed thing is nice is, again, depending on your camera body, some of them can do third stop increments.
Right.
Some, like my old F4, can only do whole increments. And so I would always set it up, you know, depending on the specific camera I was taking. So there's not a lot to specify, and it's really pretty easy. And you just, you know, look through the viewfinder and push the button, and you get the reading. Now, it's also got the incident light meter, and that's a completely different thing.
Yeah, I'm noticing that. There's a white dome on the top of your meter. It's on a little swivel.
The spot meter reads what's called reflected light. It's the light bouncing off your subject. And so that subject could be miles away, or it could be 15 feet away. It wouldn't matter. With the incident meter, what you're doing is you're actually, rather than reading the light bouncing off your subject, which can be influenced by whether the subject's dark or light, you'll get differing amounts. This is actually reading the light hitting your subject.
So this would be independent of all those rules we've talked about of neutral tonality, mm-hmm. because you're just measuring the light that's
right.
coming in. So this is where if you've seen sometimes on television, or if you watch shows where the photographer guy, they're doing their fashion shoot, and he comes and he holds his
right.
meter right next to the person's face.
Right.
Well, he's not measuring the light bouncing off the person's face. He's actually measuring the light that's hitting the person's face.
Right. And he was using an incident light meter in those situations.
Now, the only way this works, though, is if you can get really close to your subject.
Or put the meter in the same light that's hitting the subject.
Okay.
Both work.
So if you're in a, if you know your subject, say in the sun, and you're on a bright sunny day, then as long as you're measuring that, you should be pretty good, pretty good to go.
And what you do is you just place it at the subject and point it back toward the camera position. That's what you want to do. And again, the nice thing about it is it doesn't matter if the subject is dark or light or neutral toned. You'll still get the correct exposure with it. And we tried some, you know, little sample things here. We did a shot earlier this morning of some subject matter that was predominantly light colored. And, you know, there were some medium tone things mixed in there, but also a lot of areas that were light, and it was in uniform light. And what we did first is had you do a shot just using the normal matrix metering in your D2X camera. And you set the exposure, you know, via manual exposure.
And I just read off the meter. And,
And then what we did was we used my handheld light meter in the incident metering mode and took a reading. And the difference between the two was fairly sizable. I think the one in your, the meter in your camera said an 80th of a second.
Correct.
And with my handheld light meter, it showed a 30th of a second. So fairly different. That's more than an f-stop of difference. Now, this is where we get into the idea of is a handheld meter still of use with a digital body? When we looked at the histogram on the back of your camera, when you did the use the in-camera meter, it looked a little bit underexposed. You know,
it was a little bit
gap
to
the
right. Yeah, definitely.
Right. Interestingly, when we looked at the one taken with the incident light meter, it showed that it was, you know, it was potentially a bit overexposed with blown highlights. It's like, oh gosh.
Yeah, I had I turned the blinkies on and things were blinking.
Right. Now I'm sure immediately you thought, well, Rick's dumb for having a handheld light meter. Now,
no, I think you're dumb for other reasons.
Well, that's probably valid.
I don't need the light meter.
So, Now, let's look at the actual images on the computer, not react too much to the histogram. So we downloaded them. And
these were shot in RAW.
And lo and behold, guess what? The one, you know, with the that used the in-camera meter, definitely underexposed. The one with the incident light meter was just spot on. Were there some highlights burned out? Yeah, but they were extremely tiny sections of the frame. It didn't matter.
And if I had been setting, just to jump in for a second, if I had been setting with a white point with an eyedropper, I would have done it exactly the way that the image came out of the camera.
Right.
So I wouldn't have had to go through and done that.
Right. So it was, you know, an excellent exposure. And what that shows you is that sometimes that histogram is very conservative. And, you know, if you're not familiar with it, the way the histograms on the cameras actually work is there's a little tiny JPEG that's produced when you make the image. And that's what the histogram is based off of. It's not really the raw file per se. And there are some other things in there with different color zones and stuff like that. The net result is it's usually on the conservative side, and even when it's saying that highlights are blown out, oftentimes they're not, if it's not horrible overexposure. So anyway, we pulled the images on there, and like I said, the one made with the incident light meter was, you know, a lot more accurate. One of the big benefits is if we took that underexposed image and lightened it so that it'll look more or less like the one done with the incident meter, and we could do that. Overall, it looked about the same, but then when you looked in the shadows, there was a big difference in the noise level, right?
Yeah, you're definitely going to, I mean, you have that problem no matter how you shoot. There's potentially shadow noise hiding in there. Because we used a longer exposure in the camera on the original shot, we had mitigated that noise. It was not going to show up. We didn't have to pull up those shadows artificially.
Yeah.
So that was pretty nice.
So it worked very well for that. And where I found it works equally well, portrait situations where your lighting is relatively uniform. I've found that it works very well for doing macro photography. If you're using one of the newer camera bodies, you know, with autofocus lenses where it reads off the true f-stop, even in higher magnification, it works great for that. And the spot meter works, you know, really well in a lot of landscape kind of situations, you know, for the reasons I mentioned earlier. You'd still use it with grad filters and stuff. Now, go back to the using the camera meter. Could we have been more intelligent using the camera meter? Absolutely. You know, what I probably would have done if I had been making that shot with the matrix meter, it said, you know, I've got a preponderance of lighter toned subjects, and I probably would have opened up a stop. And that would have put us, you know,
pretty close.
The advantage with the incident light meter is you don't have to worry about those things. You don't have to think about that and make those adjustments. You can just get the reading.
And one of the really nice uses of the incident meters and why you see them in studios is because they can meter. You can take a test. You can pop your strobes off. You can fire the strobes. Sometimes you can even remotely trigger your strobes from the meter itself. They got some real fancy wireless things in there now. Things like pocket wizards can be used to trigger your strobes, or even your camera with the light meter. But then it'll meter off that strobe value.
Right.
As well as whatever light is hitting your subject. And so a lot of times in the studio, the hardcore portrait photography, you'll see them do this. Mm-hmm. And that's something that your camera's meter really cannot do.
Right.
The fact that your camera is for the most part acting as a reflected light, meter rather than an incident light meter.
Yeah. There are ways of turning it into an incident light meter like we were talking about earlier today. You can take one of those expo disc things that we talked about, or a coffee filter that's white, put it over the lens, point it at your light source and get a reading, and you'll get something that's a lot like an incident light meter reading from a handheld meter.
And what we should point out is if you're doing this, you're going to want to have your camera in manual exposure mode.
Right.
So that you can control the f-stop and the shutter speed. And don't worry about what your camera's meter is saying. It might say you're overexposed or you're underexposed. Don't worry about it. Just trust the handheld meter.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, given all of that, should you run out and buy a handheld meter if you don't have one right now? Not necessarily. You know, with digital bodies.
It depends on if you work for Sikon.
Yeah, that's true. But if you're using a digital body and you're good at using the histogram, you're good at recognizing, you know, the tonalities in a photo and adjusting your matrix meter for that, or knowing when to switch to a spot meter. You can get along just fine without one, and most of the time that's what I do. But if you happen to have one that's been, you know, sitting in the closet for a few years, it might not be a bad idea to get it out. Or if you do a lot of photography of the type that I just discussed, it can still be a good investment. In fact, Sikonic's got a new meter out that's kind of like mine, only it allows you to load in exposure latitude information for your specific camera.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah, and so there are ways that you can set up alarms and stuff like that so that you know if something is going to be a blown highlight or, you know, too dark in the shadows.
So does this mean we can't trust our camera's histogram?
No. It's just you need to know its limitations.
Okay. Yeah. And you could say that about a lot of things.
Yeah.
It's not that your histogram is wrong, but it's not always the gold standard that it's sometimes made out to be.
Yeah, just like camera. Matrix metering is a good example of that, too. When we go on this Texas workshop, one of the things that we're going to do the first night, in addition to talking about how to set up your camera for the right kind of autofocus and all that kind of stuff, is we'll talk about overrides to matrix metering in certain lighting conditions, you know, like the white patches on cara birds and things like that, and how to handle those. Okay.
Well, that's excellent. That's informative, and I never really gotten to play with one of these before because, like you
said,
they're kind of
fun.
They're not cheap, and so it's been,
no, and it's
kind
one
of
other thing to
list.
Carry, but they really can be useful for certain kinds of photography.
Very cool. Well, I think that brings us to the point in our show where we give you our weekly prescription.
Yep.
And we were thinking of scratching our heads for a while to come up with something that would be of use to our audience. And this sort of goes along the lines with tips for beginners as well as the time of year. And I know around here, the Little League has started up and soccer leagues have started up, or football if you're in anywhere else besides the United States, it's
right.
Football. But you probably are trying to take pictures of your kids playing sports and probably outside playing these sports, not necessarily. And so what we wanted to offer a couple of quick tips on how to set yourself up for success for better sports pictures, probably of your kids, but not necessarily. Mm-hmm. So what do we got? Let's start with the things for how to set up your camera first. I think that would be the, if you're using a Nikon SLR camera, the first thing you'll want to do for any kind of action photography is move the little switch either on the camera or in the menus to the AF-S mode for focusing. The not to be confused with AFSL. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. See, I was just testing you, Rick. Okay. AFC mode, continuous
servo. At least I caught you this time.
Continuous servo autofocus. Yeah, I have to get another lashing from you guys. Nope, you can't catch me on this one because we caught it ourselves. Set your camera to continuous servo autofocus.
AF-C.
AFC, that's right. And that could be a switch on the front of your camera next to the lens mount. It might even be
on the LCD panel on some cameras.
Some of the other cameras. But you're going to definitely want to do this so that your focus is continuously tracking your subject. Otherwise, you're just going to set yourself up for failure unless your subject likes to stand still for long periods of time. So do that because it's not typically the default setting for your camera.
And then the next thing, listen to the last podcast and about our topic on auto ISO. With the exception of what you talked about earlier, but use that for this situation. I would recommend a minimum shutter speed of 500th of a second. That should be enough to stop most action. Mm-hmm. And, the auto ISO will make life easier. And then use shutter priority mode.
Right. And as we pointed out before,
500th of a second.
If you're at shutter priority and auto ISO, if you run out of light, the camera is not going to do anything. It's just going to start underexposing. Mm-hmm. So you'll have to just pay attention to that. You might need to drop to a slower shutter speed. But realistically, you don't want to be below a 250th of a second. You really want to be up around 1,000th of a second if you can get away with it, especially for some of the fast-paced sports like baseball where they're swinging bats or balls are being thrown. If you want to freeze that action, a 500th of a second isn't even fast enough for it. Mm-hmm. But anywhere in there, that's what you're going to want to do. Freeze that action and use that continuous autofocus mode. Mm-hmm. Now, then the last things you can do, we got a couple of suggestions for your composition when shooting sports, because you come home at the end of the day, you got a bunch of shots with kids, and if it weren't for the fact that they're wearing their uniforms, you might not know what they're doing. It kind of just looks... Something's wrong with your pictures and you don't know what. And what makes a good sports picture from a not so good sports picture, all other things being equal, get the ball in the frame. It's really important. All of a sudden when there's a ball, it sort of focuses your interest. That's what they're looking at. They're looking at the soccer ball. Mm-hmm. Or if you can get the baseball in the shot, that's a really good thing. Otherwise, when you freeze the action like you're doing, sometimes it just makes it look like people in uniform standing around.
Right.
You know, and so try to capture those moments where you've actually got the ball in the frame. And that takes practice.
Yeah, and watch for the peak of activity. And it can be right when the foot strikes the ball or right when the ball is caught. Or just about to be caught. You know, look for those moments.
Right. And the best way to do that is to put your camera into the continuous frame advance drive rather than the single frame at a time. You should be able to hold down a burst of, you know, three shots, four shots, and one of those will have the ball in it.
But still try to get that peak, because even at a high frame rate, it's amazing how quickly subject moves around and you could miss that moment.
There's a lot to be said about timing in sports photography. Mm-hmm. And then the last little tip, which is something that's very easy to overlook, is to pay attention to the background in your shot. It's so easy when you're shooting sports or any kind of action photography to be so intently dialed in your brain on your subject to try to make sure that you have them framed properly, that you're not even thinking about your background. And usually where you can think about your background is before the game even starts. Think about where you're going to position yourself. If you have a choice, if you can move around the field, then maybe you shouldn't put yourself so that you see the fence right behind the players or street or cars. You know, try to get clean backgrounds. Another thing that's going to help you with is your autofocus performance. If you have subjects that could potentially be overlapping in the viewfinder. And I saw an example of this. Let's say you're at a baseball game and you got the pitcher and you're right, you know, you've got the pitcher and you're looking right at him. If there's an outfielder right behind the pitcher, and by that I mean in the background, it is quite possible that your camera in the heat of action as the pitcher is getting ready to move from a standing position to a bent over position and delivering the ball, that your camera could just track onto that outfielder who's fairly stationary out there. And then you have a whole bunch of questions as to why didn't your camera focus right? And it has nothing to do with your camera. It can be mitigated by simply changing where you stand.
So the most important reason to have a clean background is just that the shot will be much nicer. You won't have those distracting elements out there compositionally, but there is a secondary benefit, which is your autofocus is more likely to stay locked on to your principal subject.
Right. Yeah. And all the other rules apply. Try not to cut off hands. That doesn't mean you can't get close and just shoot the upper half of a person, but try to keep hands in the frame when you can. And I realize that that's easier said than done. That's not always an easy thing.
Right.
But those tips will at least get you going in the right direction for shooting sports photography as we come into spring and summer here.
And this is a wonderful situation for digital. Take a bunch of shots, delete a bunch of shots too. But it's definitely one of those subject matters that benefits from, you know, just trying a whole bunch of different approaches and timing. Okay.
All right. Well, we made it through another episode. We're still alive. Hopefully you guys are. Don't forget to send us your questions to our email address at talkradio@nikonians.org. Check us out on the show notes page.
Yeah. And once again, we definitely appreciate the feedback on websites like Podcast Alley. And we've got links to that in the show notes area, as well as iTunes.
That's right. Vote for us if you like us. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right. Bye-bye.